In a world full of lies and deception, it takes courage to speak truth. In a nation half-bent on its own destruction, it takes honor to seek a return to glory. Join us in cutting through the lies and propaganda. It's time for Cutting Through the Chaos on the America Out Loud Network. Here is your host, Wallace Garneau.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to a Cutting Through the Chaos on the America Out Loud Network, where we cut through the lies and the propaganda to bring you the out loud truth. I'm your host, Wallace Garneau, and I've got a couple of important topics I want to talk to you today. I really want to get into a little bit of economics to explain just how bad the economics of our country are right now. Before I do that, I would be absolutely remiss if I did not spend some of the show talking about all the lunacy happening on American campuses. So the first topic I'm going to talk about is that, and then in the second part of the show, we're going to go into some economics. I'm going to explain to you just how bad things are, and you certainly feel it every time you go to the grocery store. I'm going to give you some numbers, some statistics. I'm going to illustrate just how bad things are, and we'll get to that later. But first, the lunacy going on our college campuses is really, really striking. I remember after September 11th, I think anybody who is old enough to remember September 11th, 2001, and what the country was like before that is absolutely shocked that there are people protesting in support of Hamas on our college campuses, in our big cities, shutting down bridges, taking over buildings on college campuses, and just saying horrendous things. One of the chants that they've used is, "We hope October 7th happens 10,000 times over." Another one, of course, is "Death to America," and various things like that. And that's happening on the United States, in the United States, on our college campuses. It's happening everywhere. Big cities across the country. It's absolutely insane. And in one sense, you know, it puts Democrats in a very, very awkward spot, which is why we're seeing Democrats doing such crazy things. But what scares me about this is I can remember after September 11th, it only took a couple of days before Noam Chomsky started talking about what we did to them, as he put it, that caused them to then lash out against us. In other words, according to Noam Chomsky, September 11th was not the fault of the terrorists. The terrorists were reacting righteously against American hostility in their part of the world. Now, Noam Chomsky was, of course, completely wrong on that. When it comes to things outside of linguistics, I find that Noam Chomsky is generally wrong about everything. He's one of these guys that, you know, is brilliant in a particular area, highly studied, highly regarded in a very narrow, specific area, linguistics in his case. Probably the world's greatest expert on linguistics. And then when he moves out of linguistics, it's as if he thinks he's still an expert. And it's like, no, Mr. Chomsky, now you just sound like you're dumb. And you know, we see a lot of this where people that will have a very, very specific focus of knowledge. And maybe they have all the doctorates in the world within that small particular area. And they think that this gives them some kind of special knowledge in other areas. When you hear them talking, it becomes very, very obvious they know nothing about it. So Noam Chomsky talking about how September 11th was our fault very shortly after September 11th. Well, I wondered today if we had a similar style attack, what the response would be. Would it unify the country as it did for the most part after September 11th? Or would we find ourselves even more divided, where many Americans would be supporting the terrorists rather than supporting the country? Really, really scares me. You know, when you see people saying that they hope that October 7th happens 10,000 times over. The interesting thing is, some of the same people also deny that October 7th happened at all. They did a poll, for example, in the Gaza Strip, and they found that 74% of Gazans backed Hamas, knowing what happened on October 7th. They found that 90 to 95% of Muslims country by country hate Jewish people. It's a very high number in the Gaza Strip, one of the highest numbers in any Muslim-controlled area. So the hatred for Jewish people is everywhere within really the entire Muslim community, the entire Muslim world. And you see a tremendous amount of support for what happened on October 7th on our college campuses. And again, it just blows my mind. They claim that it didn't happen, then they say they want it to happen again and again and again. And you know, the crazy thing here is, that Hamas, when they went into Israel on October 7th, they wore body cameras. So everything they did, they videotaped, and then they went out on YouTube, which doesn't print conservative content. They'll take a lot of conservative content down for being conservative. They'll give up, you know, spurious reasons for doing so. They let Hamas post their videos of all the things that Hamas did. And it's things like taking babies from crying mothers, putting the baby in the microwave, and then cooking the baby in the microwave while the mother cries, and then dragging the mother and her young other children out in the street to rape and kill them. That's the kind of stuff that Hamas was videotaping themselves doing. And Hamas released those videotapes. They made like greatest hits videos of all of the most horrific things that they did on October 7th. And, you know, it was Hamas that released it. So for people to try to deny that it didn't happen or say that it wasn't horrific, you know, what the hell's happening to our country? But we're seeing some very, very strange bedfellows coming out of this, though. Eric Adams, for example, who I don't think I have ever agreed with about anything in my life before, made a couple of statements. She made a very long statement, a couple of excerpts from it. He said, there is a movement to radicalize young people. And then he said, this is a global problem that young people are being influenced by those who are professionals in radicalizing our children. Now, he's talking about Hamas. He's talking about Iran. He's talking about Russia. He's talking about China. He's talking about countries and organizations that have goals and ambitions that involve not just tearing apart the United States, but tearing apart the Western world in general. And he's absolutely right. There's an organization that's sponsoring some of these demonstrations on our campuses that Goldman Sachs just gave like $13 million to. So the funding for this is coming from all over the place. George Soros is giving large amounts of money to these protesters and these groups that are chanting death to America, and we hope October 7th happens 10,000 times over. I think about Osama bin Laden's letter, which has become kind of, young people are reading it and agreeing with it. And the letter I'm talking about is the one where he wrote to the American people about why he was justified in making the attack on September 11th, all of the things that he said we had done to precipitate that. And young Americans are reading that, and they're finding that they agree with it. And Osama bin Laden, within our younger communities, is starting to become a bit of a folk hero, as crazy as that may be. And, you know, it's insane. I haven't seen this much stupidity since 2020, when 19 people were killed in the first 14 days of the Black Lives Matter riots across the country, which was completely ignored by our press. You know, everybody was saying it was a summer of love. Everybody was saying that these were mostly peaceful protests. CNN couldn't find a camera angle that didn't have a burning building, but they still called it mostly peaceful, even as I said, 19 people were killed in 14 days. So it's absolutely insane. There was an incident in Texas where at the University of Texas, they said to the police, and it's entirely possible that that particular protest really was peaceful. But even when it's being peaceful, and when people are saying from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, what they're saying is kill 7.2 million Jewish people and eradicate a nation. That's an incitement to violence. It's just an incitement to violence that is being, you know, they're walking right up to the line of legality and not quite crossing it. Because it's probably not illegal to say from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. It is illegal to incite the death of the people that live there, which that is, comes dangerously close to doing, but I don't know what happened at the University of Texas when the police were called in and put down what indications are may have been just a peaceful protest. Maybe they were inciting violence. I don't know. But now that's in the media as a right-wing overreaction to all of the crazy things that are happening. Joanna King Slutsky, and that really is her name, Joanna King Slutsky, and it's hyphenated, so it's Joanna King / Slutsky, which indicates that at some point she had the opportunity to just be Joanna King, and she said, no, I like the name Slutsky. Yes, I'm picking on her name because I find it funny. She's one of the heads of the Columbia protest, and what Joanna King Slutsky did was she gave a press conference in which she told the press repeatedly that she was asking the campus of the Columbia University, she was asking for them to agree not to prevent the protesters, this is when they were still holding the Hamilton building, to prevent them from bringing in supplies. And it was kind of hilarious because the reporters began asking her questions about, you know, has the campus actually tried to stop you from bringing in food and water? And she said, well, I don't have any indications, or I can't talk about that. I don't know what the answer is. But we're asking them to agree not to do this. And what she was trying to do was she was trying to proactively, before the campus had actually done anything that she could say was preventing them from getting food and water, she was trying to accuse them of having done that when they hadn't actually done anything like that. It was, if you haven't seen Joanna King-Slutsky talk, it's actually kind of comical, and it's worth seeing just because she gets twisted into knots trying to make it sound like Columbia University is actually doing something it's not. Perhaps the most interesting thing here, though, is the way it's putting Democrats in such a difficult position, which is why you see people like Eric Adams saying that it needs to be stopped, while people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez are cheering for the protesters and saying that you know, we're oppressing and we need to stop killing Gazans and all of these crazy things. You have Joe Biden. On the one hand, he gave a speech today, in which he said, today at the time of the recording, in which he denounced the protests and the things they're protesting about and violence against Jewish people and everything else. And then it also was released by the Biden administration that they're thinking about taking large numbers of people from Gaza and permanently relocating them into the United States. Now, that's an interesting idea because if you do polls of the people in Gaza, they would like to destroy the United States. This is not a part of the world where people like the United States. There are parts of the Muslim world where people do like the United States. Like if you go into northern Iran and Iraq, into part of Turkey where you have the Kurds. That's a Muslim group, and we rate very highly with them. About 80% of them love the United States, which is actually higher than a similar Pew survey done in the United States. We're actually more popular in that part of the Arab world than we are in our own country because a lot of Americans right now seem to have a death wish. But so you're seeing Democrats trying to, on the one side, distance themselves from the anti-Semitism and the anti-Israeli sentiment, and on the other side, trying to keep the vote of the young people that are inciting violence and that are having these protests where they're you know, shutting down colleges, attacking Jewish people, preventing Jewish people from going to school, preventing Jewish professors from going onto college campuses, preventing, you know, Columbia University had to go to, well, for the rest of the semester, they had to go to all distance learning because they were afraid that Jewish students would not be safe on campus. And it was because of protesters, you know, the same one, Joanna King-Slutsky. She's one of them. She's one of the leaders. And this is happening in our country today, and it's the craziest thing I've ever seen. My perspective is, if I were the president of the United States on October 8th, or even later on October 7th, I would have told Benjamin Netanyahu, I would have said, look, we're not going to fund you eradicating Hamas in the Gaza Strip, but nor are we going to pull the funding that we're already giving you, and we're not going to stop you from doing it. If you want to launch a ground invasion, go ahead and do it. Obviously, we don't want to kill innocent civilians, but you have to kill off Hamas. It is time for that to happen, and we're gonna let you do that. We're not gonna hold you back, and we will let you fight Hamas until every member of Hamas is dead. To me, that's the correct way to handle this. If Hezbollah wants to get up in a tiffy, fine. Go into Lebanon and wipe out Hezbollah. Also, if Iran wants to get all up into a tiffy, we can bomb Iran into the Stone Age. I'm okay with these sorts of things right now, and I'm okay with these sorts of things because I look at what is happening within our own country, and I look at what is happening in Europe. And Hamburg, Germany, they had about 40,000 protesters, the Islamist protesters, that were protesting the existence of Germany and of the Western world and calling for a one-world caliphate in Germany. 40,000 of them. And just the audacity. We're going to flee our war-torn country, go to your country, and then demand that your country not exist. You know, this is insanity. In England, in London, they have giant, giant, giant protests that are anti-England, anti-America, anti-Israel, pro-Hamas, pro-ISIS. They'll have ISIS flags and these things. And they'll get like sometimes 200,000 people to these things. And downtown London, for God's sake, London, by the way, more than half of the people living in London today were not born in England. And I'm not saying that they're not English. I'm saying they're not. They were not born in England. So this does not include, say, people that migrated to England from other parts of the world that had children. Those children are living in London, but they were born in England. More than half of the people in London today were not born in England, which is, to me, absolutely insane. And you look at where the world is headed. The side that wants to destroy the West, they're winning. And they have the backing of our college campuses. They largely have the backing of our mainstream media. They've infiltrated and implanted people into our government is overrun by them at the bureaucratic level. The Democrat Party seems very, very sympathetic to the groups that want to destroy the United States. They're funded by China. They're funded by Iran. They're funded, I'm sure, by Russia. They're funded by the enemies of the United States. They're funded by terrorist organizations. And, you know, Black Lives Matter, Antifa, these pro-Gaza, pro-Hamas protests, it's all one organization, and the goal of it, the goal of Hamas and Iran are not to have, you have different groups that are funding these sorts of things that actually have different goals, but they all agree on the need to take down the United States and to take down the Western world in general. And, you know, the only thing about this that I find in any way positive is that Democrats trying to play both sides are also alienating both sides. And I really, really, really think this is going to cost them big time in the election, because I don't think these protests are going to stop. I think we're going to see a summer like we did in 2020, where it just continues all the way through until it gets cold out again. This could continue in some parts of the country all the way to the election. And I think the percentage of Americans that are in favor of this sort of thing, and particularly when it's pro-Hamas and anti-Israel and all that, I think the percentage of Americans that are in favor of this or even sympathetic to it is relatively small. But these are all Democrat voters. This entire anti-Israel, anti-Semitic movement, this is all Democrats. This is all coming from the left. And it's devastating to them, because what do they always say? They always say, well, maybe you're not a Nazi, but if the Nazis are voting for you, isn't that a problem? Well, I never thought the Nazis were Republicans. I've argued consistently that the Nazis are really, you know, when they say that they are the alt-right, what they're saying is we are in opposition to the left, but we're actually an alternative to the right. So they don't agree with the right. They might vote against the left, but they are not a part of the right. They're actually, if you look at all of their beliefs and everything, and I talked about this last week, they have far more in common with the left than the left of them are exactly the same. They only disagree on what races they think should be on top of the pyramid. If you look at the neo-Nazi groups in the United States and you look at the Democratic Party, hell, look at the Democrats, look at their published platform and compare it to the 25 points that Hitler ran on. You'll see that now that you throw anti-Semitism into the mix as a leftist ideology, all of a sudden you could almost pass Hitler's 25 points off as the Democratic Party official platform. They are that similar now, and I find all of this insane. But this is where we are as a country. So I don't know what to think about it. I don't know what to do about it. I'm very happy that the mayor of New York is saying that the New York police are not going to allow it any further in the city of New York. I understand that Columbia has basically backed down from having any of these protesters more than arrested. They pushed them off campus, but you know they're not expelling anybody. They're not asking for anybody to go to jail. And so it's just going to happen again and again and again, just like in 2020 and 2021, when we saw, you know, all of the protests and the rioting and the looting and the arson, and nobody was really held accountable for it. You know, at one point, they had encircled off of a federal courthouse and were trying to set it on fire. Nobody got in any trouble for that. So this whole thing is just mind-boggling. And the only positive from it is that it's probably going to put Trump back in the White House. I think he might win. Now, obviously, there are going to be some shenanigans in the election, but I think that he might win by a margin so wide that it's not even conceivable to cheat. So that's the one positive from all of this, is it may really help to get Trump back into the White House. So that's my take on that. I was not going to talk about it, but then there have been some more recent news events, and this is something that has to be talked about, so I decided to go ahead and spend about 20 minutes on it. Now I want to go back to a different topic. This is economics. I'll start it, and we'll go to our break, and then I'll finish on the other side of the break. Our country is bankrupt, and I've said that a number of times, that our country is bankrupt. The truth of the matter is that our country can't be bankrupt. When Joe Biden says that a federal government that prints its own currency cannot go bankrupt, he's absolutely right. Our government will always be able to pay off its bills simply by printing more money and using the additional money to pay off the bills. It's absolutely true. The federal government issues new currency and can always issue new currency to pay its debts and other obligations. As such, the federal government can never go bankrupt. It's a very easy economic lesson. It's something you should remember. The federal government of the United States, because it prints its own currency, cannot go bankrupt. Government of Greece can. The government of Italy can. And they did a number of times recently because they don't print their own currency. If they did print their own currency, they would not go bankrupt. They would just print money to pay their bills. But that doesn't mean that there is no negative impact to the government printing money to pay its debts and obligations. Because while it is true that a federal government that issues its own currency can never go bankrupt, what it can do is to bankrupt all the people living under it. So understand, I have said a number of times that our government is bankrupt. What I really mean by that is not that the federal government itself is bankrupt. What I mean is that you are bankrupt. And you are. You're bankrupt. If you're listening to this, believe me, you're bankrupt. So am I. I am bankrupt. Your neighbor is bankrupt. My neighbor is bankrupt. Your friends and family are bankrupt. My friends and family are bankrupt. Everybody in this country, unless they are part of the privileged elite representing maybe 0.1%, we're all bankrupt. And we are bankrupt because the federal government of the United States has put itself in a position where the only way that it can pay its debts and obligations is by printing more money, creating more inflation, devaluing our currency, and this is a process that is just going to get worse and worse and worse every year. Let me illustrate this with a true historic event. There was an old shopkeeper in the Weimar Republic of Germany, and the Weimar Republic, for those who haven't studied a lot of history, existed between the end of World War I and the rise of Hitler. And this shopkeeper did everything right. He pinched his pennies. He did well by his customers, but he didn't waste money. He was a very, very, he bought products people wanted, sold them at reasonable values, had good turns, ran his business well. And what he did is he spent his entire career living frugally and running his shop frugally on the hope that he would have a nice retirement and be able to leave a nice nest egg to his children. And it worked. Over time, he ended up with an absolute fortune in the bank. Then as his retirement began to approach, he felt very, very secure until one day he got a letter from the bank. And what the letter said is, could you please come in? Excuse me, he didn't get a letter from the bank. He got a phone call from the bank. And what the bank asked him is, could you please come down to the bank so we can give you your money back? We would love, you don't have enough anymore, be able to hold open an account. And while we would love to just mail you a check, the value of your holdings is no longer enough to buy a postage stamp. Now, this particular individual and millions of people like him had gone from being wealthy, not just a little wealthy, this guy had a lot of money, he was very wealthy, to being absolutely poor in just a few days. And the reason was because the value of the currency was depleting that quickly. It was so bad in the Weimar Republic for a period of time that employers had to pay their employees twice a day. They would pay them at lunch so that they could eat lunch, and then they would pay them at the end of the day so they could go buy dinner on the way home. And the reason they had to do that is because if they only paid them at lunch, by the end of the day, the money they had paid them at lunch was no longer worth anything, and they couldn't buy lunch with it, or they couldn't buy dinner with it. And if they only paid them at the end of the day, then by lunch the next day, they couldn't afford to eat. So it was so bad, businesses were actually paying their employees twice a day. And now, I don't know if it's ever going to get that bad here, but if I look at the federal budget of the United States, for example, in the year 2007, what I see is that the largest item is a combination of Medicare and Medicaid. which at the time came out to 22.18% of the federal budget. The next highest item on the budget was Social Security at 21.41% of the federal budget. Interest on the national debt ran at about 9.1% of the federal budget, and we had a problem with that at the time. Everybody was talking about the deficits that George W. Bush was running. We weren't happy with those numbers. We thought we were spending too much on I did not think we were spending too much on defense. But a lot of people thought that we were spending too much money on national defense. Well, it turns out that national defense is only, at that time, it was the third highest item on the federal budget. And it only accounted for about 4%, a little less than 4%, about 3.6% of GDP. Now, a lot of countries spend more than 3.6% of their GDP on national defense. We don't actually spend an egregious amount of money on national defense. People say we do, but that's not really true. If you look at it as in pure dollar amounts, then yes, we spend far more on national defense than any other country on earth. But, you know, we're a rich country. We have a very, very big GDP. And with an economy the size of ours, we have more interests to defend than a lot of other countries do. And that necessitates that we spend more money on defense. And we do a very good job, for the most part, with spending money on defense. We lose money. We lost billions of dollars in the war with Afghanistan and Iraq that just, poof, it disappeared. Nobody knows where it went. We've lost billions of dollars that just disappeared in Ukraine, supporting them. That's all out of the Defense Department budget. There's a belief that Hunter Biden may have gotten $1 billion of U.S. aid that went into a bank account in Cyprus, which they have some of the most secretive banking laws in the world. So if you can get your, once the money is in the bank in Cyprus, there's no way to determine who has it. They don't know for sure that this went to Hunter Biden, but it did go through Burisma Holdings, and it went through processes at Burisma Holdings that Hunter Biden has laundered money through before. So the belief is that $1 billion is now belongs to the Biden family. There are a lot of people. She read a book recently. I don't have it with me, but there's a lot of people. The same guy that wrote Clinton Cash, Secret Empires, I believe it's called. And the speculation there is that the Biden family actually has more money than the Trump family. Now, I don't think it might not be true today, because with the IPO of the Truth Network, Donald Trump is richer than he's ever been before. So he may, again, have more money than the Bidens. But the belief there is that the Biden family, prior to Truth Network going IPO, that the Biden family actually had more money in offshore accounts than the Trump family has, period, as crazy as that may sound. But, you know, tremendous amount of corruption in those dollars, but it's really not a gregarious amount what we spent on national defense. If we look at where we are today, on the other hand, the proposed 2024 budget, the largest item on that is still Medicare and Medicaid. The next highest item is still Social Security, which now is $1.459 trillion. We're now spending $885 billion on national defense. That's only gone up a little bit. Social Security has gone up a lot. Medicare and Medicaid have gone up a lot. And incidentally, your health insurance is about to go up, because Joe Biden just changed Obamacare in such a way that now all of the trans care is going to be covered under health insurance. So if someone wants to transition their gender, then now that's going to be paid for through their insurance, which means it's going to be paid for. It's going to socialize that cost where every American is going to have to pay for it. The graph shows net interest at only $789 billion, but that's not true. It's actually going to be $870 billion, according to the CBO, because the inflation rate is higher than what the inflation rate has been called before. Those are numbers that we just cannot sustain. The amount of the percentage of our GDP, the percentage of our federal budget that is encompassed by net interest, we can't afford that now. And the fact of the matter is, the reason it's only $789 billion is because a lot of that money are on bonds that were written before the interest rates went up. So a lot of that $789 billion are on bonds that, as they mature, we don't get the same interest rate. The bonds today are running at over 5%. Yes, and so this is just getting worse and worse and worse for us. it's becoming more and more and more unaffordable. Kind of as our health is becoming more difficult to maintain as well. Metabolic dysfunction affects 87% of Americans, yet most people have never heard of it. According to the NIH, this is when metabolic health markers like cholesterol, blood pressure, blood sugar, inflammation, or weight are out of whack. Often there are no symptoms, but left unattended, we become inundated with one health problem after another. Heal Right is a ready-to-eat metabolic health bar with a synergistic blend of superfood ingredients to address nutritional root causes of metabolic dysfunction in as little as 8 weeks without additional diet or lifestyle changes. I ate a bar about 2 hours ago as I record this. You might remember that last week I had a hard time saying metabolic. Today I can say metabolic, and I truly, I tell you, about an hour after I eat one of these bars, all of a sudden I just feel more alert. The bar doesn't claim that's going to happen, but it's been consistent. So I find that I like to have those bars, not just for all the benefits that they say they have, but also it feels to me like increasing my metabolic function also increases makes my brain feel younger, if you will. But Heal Right is not just effective, it's also delicious and works without additional diet or lifestyle changes. So no more worrying about the side effects of medications and figuring out how to stick to difficult diet and lifestyle changes. It beats metabolic dysfunction. It allows me to say that word. Food can be your best medicine. It tastes like a treat, acts like a medicine without the side effects. Step out of the statistics using food as medicine. 7 in 8 Americans are metabolically unhealthy. 6 in 10 suffer from at least one chronic disease. Heal Right is 15 plus years of research. It's developed by world-renowned nutritional scientists. It's got a 100% money-back guarantee. It will give you a metabolic reset with measurable improvements in just 8 weeks, including cholesterol levels, blood sugar balance, reduced inflammation, a slimmer waistline, gut health, and microbiome health. It lowers GLP-1s naturally at a fraction of the cost of prescription drugs. Each bar contains a synergistic blend of superfood ingredients needed to support metabolic health, including 20-plus essential micronutrients. It's soluble and insoluble fiber for close to 25% of total dietary fiber needs in just one serving. It's got omega-3 fatty acids. And thank you, everyone, for not telling my wife that I made a crack about her salmon a couple of weeks ago. It's got 6 grams of proteins and other building blocks for metabolic health. It's got antioxidants, and it's got only 250 calories per serving. This is not a meal replacement. You still get to eat. Try Heal Right today. Go to HealRight.com and use promo code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first purchase. That's code OUTLOUD at HealRight.com. Personally, I use Heal Right to give me back some of the metabolism of my youth. As I said, I feel more mentally focused about an hour after I take it. I also been able to remove myself completely from all cholesterol medications and all but one of my blood pressure medications. My wife eats a bar a day as well, and she agrees with me, Heal Right works. Along with a healthy diet and exercise, Heal Right can make all the difference in the world. And don't go away, we're going to get right back into it on the other side of the break, but first we'll give a moment for our sponsors.
Cholesterol, blood pressure, blood sugar, inflammation, and weight. These are all real-world problems that 87% of Americans are struggling with. Fight back with Heal Right. Heal Right is a bar you eat, but it's food as medicine that addresses the nutritional root cause of health issues in just 8 weeks. Take action today. Visit HealRight.com/OutLoud or AmericaOutLoud.shop and use the code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
The buildup of spike proteins is dangerous to your health. Global Healing's Foreign Protein Cleanse detoxes your body, removing the spike proteins, allowing your body to repair from within. Formulated by Dr. Edward Group and by Dr. Brian Artis, Foreign Protein Cleanse targets and detoxes spike proteins in the body. Go to AmericaOutLoud.shop and get 15% off using the code OUTLOUD. Global Healing, giving you the power to take control of your health naturally.
World-class care from doctors you can trust, all from the comfort of your home. That is One Wellness. Dr. Peter McCullough and his team at The Wellness Company launched the One Wellness membership to provide free monthly supplements and unlimited telemedicine access with doctors that share your values. Be a part of a revolutionary new healthcare system that puts your health and well-being above the interests of Big Pharma's bottom line. It's the way healthcare should be. Go to OutLoudCare.com today and use code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first month of One Wellness.
Who's got time for a nasal invasion messing up your lifestyle? Crush those nasties before they become a problem. For a limited time, when you add the new Cofix RX Throat Spray to your order with the coupon code OUTLOUD, you'll receive 20% off the entire purchase. Go to AmericaOutloud.shop. That's AmericaOutloud.shop and use coupon code OUTLOUD.
Use Cofix RX because it works.
Don't accept joint aches and stiffness as part of aging. Doctors at Advanced Nutrition Company, Healthy Cell, created joint health and mobility to support connective tissue, joint lubrication, and reduce joint irritation with curcumin, omega-3, chondroitin, glucosamine, and hyaluronic acid for joint comfort and flexibility. And Healthy Cell's not a pill. It's a gel you swallow. Get 100% drug-free joint support. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first order. That's HealthyCell.com. Code OUTLOUD.
A less suppression of truth in a world of darkness, void of any soul, requires that we are rightly informed, properly equipped, and strongly motivated to fight the corruption. AmericaOutloud.news is that place to awaken your heart, soul, and mind to the out loud truth. Now is our time. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Cutting Through the Chaos. We're going to get right back into it. I was talking about the amounts on the budget this year for all those various things, defense spending, net interest, Medicare and Medicaid, Social Security. It's worth understanding, we look at the interest on the debt, that as existing federal treasury notes mature, they're going to have to be rolled over into new treasury notes. There's no way that the government can actually give money to pay for them. The people will get money, but we're not taxing enough to pay those off. So what ends up happening is, in addition to needing to borrow to do the things that the government does, the federal government is going to have to borrow, making new treasury notes to pay off the old treasury notes, except that the new treasury notes are not going to be at the same low interest rates that the ones getting paid off were. Right now, current bond rates, Even on the least high paying bonds, you know, the further out you go off and the lower the percentages go, but the ones the lowest percentages now are up over 5%. So as old bonds mature and replaced by new bonds, the cost of carrying what we have right now, $34 trillion of debt, is going to rise from its current value of $870 billion a year, all the way up to $1.7 trillion a year, and that's if we don't keep adding to the debt. If we carry $37 trillion of debt, which is where we'll be in about a year, at 5%, that's $1.85 trillion. The more debt we carry relative to GDP, the higher the bond rates will go too. If we get to $40 trillion, which we probably will do in about 2 years, if Biden is reelected, we'll blow right through that. At 6%, that's $2.4 trillion a year. $2.4 trillion a year. Just to cover the interest on the national debt. And that's at $40 trillion, which is just a couple of years additional high spending. And there's really nothing we can do about that. That's just waiting for the existing bonds that were issued at low, ridiculously low interest rates to mature, so we have to roll over new bonds in order to pay the bondholders. That's if we do nothing. Now, I just said it was $2.5 trillion. Let's look at what that compares to based on the other things in the budget today. $2.5 trillion is going to be net interest if we do nothing. National defense, $885 billion. Non-defense discretionary, $1.015 trillion. Social Security, $1.459 trillion. Medicare, $842 billion. Medicaid, $558 billion. None of these are as high as the net interest payments are going to be if we do nothing as those bonds mature. At some point, just what we owe today, along with a couple more years, it's going to be not just the highest item on the it's going to be twice what the next highest item on our federal budget is. And there's nothing we can do about that. So Now what we want to do is we want to look at the tax versus spending side of the equation. In 2007, again before the crisis of 2008, we brought in total federal revenues, this including all taxes, everything the federal government gets, we came in at $2.568 trillion, and expenses came in at $2.8 trillion, a shortfall of about $200 billion. And we were upset about that. One of the things that conservatives did not like about George W. Bush was all of the crazy spending. $200 billion back then we thought was a lot of money for a deficit. We wanted to get closer to a balanced budget. And everybody's talking about how difficult it would be to have a balanced budget at that time. Well, it's much worse today. Today we're spending $6.9 trillion a year. It's actually going to be over $7 trillion because the 6.9 assumes a lower rate of inflation and lower bond payments than what is actually going to happen. So we're going to pay a little bit more than what the Biden administration said. It's going to be over $7 trillion in total expenditures this year. Revenues are coming out at just $4.9 trillion. So, you know, that's $2 trillion. It's more than $2 trillion in shortfall in 1 year. That's 10 times the deficit that we had under George W. Bush. Now, people say that we had trillion-dollar deficits under Trump, and that's true. We also had trillion-dollar deficits under Obama. We've had trillion-dollar deficits going back to 2008, when we all of a sudden spent money like it was water in order to try to prevent the fiscal crisis of 2008 from turning into a depression. Now, that was a mistake, by the way, because it was not going to become a depression. Bankruptcy laws don't work like that. It's not like if the banks go into bankruptcy that the banks stop operating. What would have happened is the banks would have gone into bankruptcy. The Federal Reserve would have had to have stepped in and provided the immediate term, the overnight liquidity that a lot of companies like Ford, Chrysler, and General Motors rely on for their operating. For operating expenses. So the Federal Reserve would have had to have stepped in and taken over the overnight lending functions that banks currently perform in order to prevent it from becoming a depression. But as long as the Federal Reserve did that, which it can do, what would have happened is the banks would have gone into bankruptcy. The portions of the banks that caused the recession in 2008 would have not come out of bankruptcy. They would have thrown those parts off. That would have been where they buy all of the where they bought all the housing-backed securities, you know, that market, and so that would have been liquidated, and then the banks would have been purchased by new people and would have come out of bankruptcy intact. Now the management of the banks would have all been laid off. The people that owned stocks in the banks would have lost their shirts, at least on that part of their stock portfolios. The bankers would have been some of them might have been jumping off of buildings the way investors were in 1929. So it would have affected some people in a very, very negative way, but it would have affected the people that caused the housing crisis in 2008. Now, they would have been the ones that were hurt. Instead, we spent trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars between 2008 and then when Trump came into office and then up until COVID-19 hit. We spent trillions and trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars trying to first prevent us from going into a recession and then trying to limp along an economy that just didn't have anything going for it. The fact of the matter is that we would have been in a recession that entire time period, again, until Trump was elected, had it not been for all of the government spending. It got so bad that the stock market, even today, the stock market doesn't react so much to improvements the stock market reacts to first and foremost is what the Federal Reserve says. I will believe that we have a healthy economy again when I see stock values rising and falling based upon things like company announcements of earnings and things like that. And they do move from that. But the big movements in the stock market today are not from earnings calls the way they should be. It's from Federal Reserve policies, expectations of Federal Reserve policies, and things along that line. The fact of the matter is right now, the government spends way, way, way too much of the money in our economy. We've got an economy that in 2022 is $25.44 trillion, which is the latest year that's available. And in the meantime, we're now spending $7 trillion a year. That's a lot of money to spend in an economy that size. And what that does is it takes money away from things, it takes investment away from things that the public actually wants and puts it in things the public doesn't want. So we're taking investment away from what we need to have more productive, better lives and spending it on things that the government wants us to want, but that there just isn't a market for. We're taking the profit away from things that are profitable in order to finance things that never will be profitable. That's just bad economics. That is something that no country ever should do, and that our country now is, it's a tremendous amount of money that we're doing that in. More importantly, though, we've never really been able to tax more than about 18% of our GDP. Now, we've had top marginal rates that were as high as 92%. But if I put a graph of the top marginal rate against a graph of total federal revenues going back to when the income tax first went up to, going back to the end of the Depression, basically, and I go all the way forward, what I find is that sometimes it might peak over 20 for a year or two, but it drops right back down. Sometimes it might drop below 18 for a year or two, but it comes right back up. Really, it tracks along at about 18%, does that very, very consistently, and it just keeps chugging along at about 18% of our GDP, no matter what the top marginal rates are. Over that time period, and you can actually go back to the beginning of the federal income tax in 1930, it's just that government spending and tax rates initially were so very, very low that it wasn't anywhere near 18%. It was at 3% up into the 30s. But when you see the level of spending just explode, our ability to pay for it has been restrained by the ability to collect for the federal government only about 18% of GDP. And, you know, they've been experimenting now. We've got an 80-year time period that we can look at and see, you know, and what all the different changes have made to tax policy and everything else, where the federal government has been trying to figure out how to get more than that 18%. They just haven't been able to do it. There probably are ways they could do it. Some countries, for example, have a GST tax or a value-adding tax. And what that does is it's essentially a federal sales tax, which would go on top of all of the other taxes. If they were to throw on, say, a 15% GST tax or value-added services tax, that would raise total federal revenue up over 20% of GDP. But at the same time, it would do so at the expense of the American people, who would feel much poorer. One of the reasons why our federal government has not been able to do something like that is because every time they try to get the level of taxation high enough to start getting over 20% of GDP being taken in taxation, we go into a recession, and then they have to reverse policy. So it has been impossible for the entire course of our nation's history for the government to consistently get 20% or more of GDP in taxes, no matter what the rates are, no matter what the tax policies are, and it's just not going to happen. As a matter of fact, you can look at it during the periods when Reagan and Bush cut taxes, or when Trump cut taxes. And what you see is the level of taxes collected stays very, very steady, right around 18%. So the rates have nothing to do with the amount of taxes collected. What they have to do is they have to do with the percentage of taxes collected come from different groups. So we go back to 1980. The top marginal tax rate was 70%, and the amount of taxes, the percentage of taxes paid by the top 1% was at 15%. The top 1% of income earners had a 70% top marginal tax rate. They paid about 15% of total taxes. Fast forward to 2007, the time period I looked at under George W. Bush, when we were upset about deficits of $200 billion, but still had something that resembled a healthy economy. The top marginal tax rate was down to 20%. That was after the George W. Bush tax cuts. And the share of income taxes paid by the top 1% was up to 40% of total taxes paid. And if you drop down to the top 10% of income earners, then all of a sudden it's 70% of taxes paid by the top 10% of income earners. Half of Americans pay no income taxes at all. So that's the way it works. But the concept that the higher marginal tax rates are going to increase tax revenues, that's not true. Tax revenues are going to be about 20% of GDP. If you want to increase tax revenues, the only real way to do it is to increase GDP faster, which is what happens when you lower the top marginal rate. The other thing that happens is that when you have a 70% top marginal rate, people that make a lot of money, they look for tax havens, which could be offshore. Those tax havens could be municipal bonds. They put their money into things where it's not taxed. They put their income where it can't be taxed, and they keep it in those tax havens until the rates come down. So you're not able to tax that higher income. When you drop the rates down to something reasonable, like 20% of the top marginal rate, all of a sudden, the rich people start paying taxes on that income. So even though the top marginal rate may have come down, the amount of money taxed explodes. And when they take that money out of the Cayman Islands and bring it into the United States, now they can spend it, and it can help our economy grow. So the concept that a higher tax rate increases tax revenues is just a myth. Tax rates and tax revenues are two completely separate things. In a healthy economy, you're not taxing $1 and then you're done. You're taxing the same dollar every time it changes hands. So when you go to the store and spend it, the business pays taxes, the business pays an employee, the employee pays taxes, that person buys something, taxes paid again. And so what you want is money changing hands. You want to have economic activity. It's the economic activity that causes tax, not rates, but tax revenues to go up. And you know, if we were smart, we wouldn't care about rates as much as revenues, because those that want the government to spend more money, you would think they would understand that the government can spend more money if the government has more money to spend. What they're doing right now is they're just printing money like it's going out of style and causing inflation. And we're at a point now where it'd be very, very difficult to do anything about that. Joe Biden says if he's reelected, he's going to raise taxes on everyone making more than $400,000 per year, but he will not raise taxes on anyone making less than $400,000 per year. That's actually, if he did that, that would reduce tax revenues, even though it would increase tax rates. But the other thing is that that's a bold-faced lie. Joe Biden is not raising tax rates on anyone making less than $400,000 a year, but what he is doing is he's having the child tax credit. He's having the standard exemption. He's having other exemptions used by everyday Americans. So the amount of money that you are allowed to earn before you start paying taxes, Joe Biden is going to cut that in half, which means that the half of Americans that are not paying taxes, many of them are going to start to do so. And it means that if you've got three children and you get a $5,000 tax credit for each of them, every year when you pay or don't pay your taxes, you get a check from the government because of your kids. He's going to have that. And when you go in there and say, well, here's my standard deduction, I'm going to use my standard deduction, he's going to have that, which means that though your rates are not going to go up, every single person listening to this is going to pay a lot more in taxes if Joe Biden is reelected, because your deductions are going to go through the floorboard. Now, if both parties were really interested in raising tax revenues, we would see a tax policy designed to take an 18% on average of U.S. GDP while maximizing the growth of the U.S. economy such that the size of the economy we are taxing is growing as quickly as possible. Because the gap between total revenues and total expenditures is going to be 15% this year, as another $2 trillion get added to the federal debt. If Biden is elected, it'll be 20% next year as all forms of government spending continue to grow faster than the economy and as the interest payments on the debt also continue to climb. Ladies and gentlemen, we owe $34 trillion today. In 1 year, it'll be $36 or $37 trillion. Current bond rates are paying at over 5%. So, as I said, in a few years, we could very easily be paying $2.4 trillion a year just on interest of the national debt. And that's more than we brought in just a couple of years ago in taxes. So, we're getting to the point where every penny we get in taxes is going to have to service our debt. And then what are we going to use to pay for national defense? What are we going to use to pay for Social Security? Ladies and gentlemen, we're bankrupt. And we are bankrupt because of radical spend and burn administrations like the one currently in the White House. Joe Biden says Republicans want to gut Social Security and Medicare, but that's just not true. Not a single Republican is saying that we should do either of those things. Donald Trump has been very, very consistent. He wants to protect those programs and even make them better. He wants to make them stronger, he says. I'm not saying we shouldn't do something with Social Security and Medicare. I actually agreed with George W. Bush that we need to find a way to privatize those programs. Chile has a privatized system. It pays its seniors an average of five times more than the return on investment that our seniors get. So I look at our system and people say, well, you're trying to screw over our senior citizens. I say, no, they are screwed over. I'm trying to give them some growth on the money they're investing so that they can live better lives. They should have five times what they have. They don't because of the way Social Security is structured. What Joe Biden is going to do, though, by not fixing the budget, by not getting things back under control, what he will do, this is a prediction of mine. He hasn't said he's going to do this, but there's nothing else he can do. At some point, we simply won't be able to pay Social Security at the same rate we're paying today. And what Joe Biden will do is he'll pass a law that protects Social Security by allowing raises in Social Security every year to come in at a rate much lower than the rate of inflation, meaning that our seniors will continue to get raises every year, but those raises will be much lower than the rise in costs, and they will have less buying power every year. That's what's called a soft default. Joe Biden is not going to have a hard default on Social Security, but Social Security is bankrupt, you are bankrupt, I am bankrupt. Everything but the federal government's ability to print money is bankrupt. And what the federal government is going to do is they are going to inflate away or inflate down Social Security payments to a level that it can afford by giving raises in Social Security every year well below what the actual cost of living increase is. Our seniors are going to get absolutely, you know, ladies and I hate to tell you this, but four more years of Joe Biden, our seniors are going to have a very, very hard time paying their bills because they're on a fixed income. And Joe Biden is going to keep that income at a much leveler pace than the cost of living. And from then on, our seniors will just get poorer and poorer and poorer every year. And just like that, ladies and gentlemen, we are out of time. But that's okay. We got through everything I wanted to cover. We talked a little about a craziness going on in our college campuses. And then we came in and I explained to you just how bad our economy really is. As always, thanks for tuning in. Please tell others who might be interested in cutting through the chaos to listen in either on Saturday and Sunday at 9 a.m. Eastern Standard Time or on podcast whenever they have the time. And we will see you next week at the same time and place where it will once again be time to get involved and to get loud on America Out Loud.